So thank you, everyone. Thanks to all the people making this possible. You're doing an amazing job. I'm going to present today for the KDE Eco Project. I'm one of the people who's helping coordinate. The actual real hard work is done by several dozen contributors, some of whom are here today. Before we get started, so the title of my talk is Software Licensing for a Circular Economy. What's FOSS got to do with it? There's a lot of citations in the slides. If you want to download them and look up some of the resources later, feel free to scan the QR code. If you remind me, I'll come back to this during the Q&A. You can also go to the website eco.kde.org and you'll find the slides at some point in the repositories that are linked there. So I usually don't do a who is at the beginning of my talks because the work is actually being done, the real hard work is being done by other people. And I'm here just trying to spread the message about what is being done. But the topic today actually has a personal connection with me. And I'm gonna start so this is a picture of a punk band from Washington, D.C. called Fugazi. I grew up in the like 90s, early 2000s, DIY, the do-it-yourself punk scene. And I find that there's a really seamless connection with moving into the hacker space and the maker space. There's a lot of overlapping ideas about doing. A duocracy, not waiting for permission or a certain expertise to get involved, a rejection of gatekeepers to doing things. This band Fugazi is probably one of my favorite bands, and they have a great song about a social critique of consumerism, which is quoted here. Merchandise, it keeps us in line. Common sense says it's by design. What could a businessman ever want more than to have us sucking in his store? I'm going to come back to that quote at some point in the slides. I wasn't involved in free software until about 15 years ago when my mom gave me a laptop that when she got it was quite a powerful machine. This was probably the late 90s. Nowadays it would be antique hardware. And she gave it to me because there was no operating system that she could update and use with that hardware. And me in my sort of thrifty DIY mentality coming from the punk scene was like, okay, cool, I'll try to see if I can make this work. And that, of course, led me to Linux because there was no other option. That hardware was unusable except for running a Linux distribution. And I tried a couple of different ones, landed on, I think it was XFCE at the time, and continued to use that hardware. And that put me on a journey which led me down to the free software community, the hacker spaces, and now here at CCC. That's pretty much what my talk is about. Right, that experience of getting an old laptop that had no value to someone else and then giving it new value is what this talk is about in a nutshell. I usually like to start by asking the audience a couple of questions. I'm going to do that again today. They're very easy questions, but please feel free to interact. The first one is, who here, just raise your hand, who here is familiar with this symbol? Okay, most of you here. Who here knows what the three R are referring to? Yeah, who wants to say it? Go ahead. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. Okay, that's the first question. The second question. This is a collection of essays. It's a fill-in-the-blank question. Just yell it out if you know the answer. I know it's quite easy. Free software, free society, right? This collection of essays is making a connection between one domain, which is free software, and another domain, which is free society. That's a huge connection, right? And how do they do it? They do it through licensing, right? It's probably the most unsexy topic, but this is how you go from one to the other. And it's licensing that guarantees the four freedoms of free software. The freedom to use, study, share, and improve the software as you want. Okay. Now, those characteristics, right, they're not features of free software. These are inherent to free software when you choose to release it under a free software license. Okay, it's intentional, it's by design. I'm going to summarize those in two words, autonomy and transparency. I'm going to use that throughout the talk. Autonomy and transparency is basically referring to the four freedoms. And I'm going to make a claim that those same characteristics are important for ecological reasons. And I'm going to apologize in advance for the play on words in the next slide, but the talk today is going to be about free software, three society, okay, or 3R society. Okay, and the idea that's driving this talk is that autonomy and transparency are what enable the 3R by design. There are other terms for enabling 3R by design. That's circular economy. Three is actually, that's not a magical number. I mean, it is a magical number, but it's there are other models that have many more than just three R's. I don't know how they all start with R, but I've seen 10 R's, 12 R's. There is a fourth R that I would be happy to talk about if anyone wants to ask about it. That's the cliffhanger at the beginning. But I'm going to focus today on the three R that was brought up earlier. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. To make a comparison, let's think about what the non-circular approach is. This is a linear economy of produce, use, and dispose. Produce here is energy, material input, production and distribution. Use, of course, is use, and then dispose would be disposal and waste and emission leakage. You can think about all stages of the linear model in terms of software or in terms of hardware. They both apply. I'm going to talk about it today where the two intersect, where software meets hardware. And I'm going to talk about it in terms of longer use to reduce e-waste, reuse, where you take something that would otherwise have no value, at least from the vendor's perspective, reusing it for other purposes, and recycling. And here I'm going to talk about it in terms of software recycling. And to compare it to what a non-free software world looks like when you're using proprietary software, these three stages, at least the way that I'm talking about it, require permission from the vendor, right? You as a user or we as a society don't have the autonomy or the transparency to reduce, reuse, and recycle. Okay, we need permission from the vendor or they need to do it for us because we don't have access to the tools that we would need to do it. One estimate, this is from a quote from Sarah King, who's a climate science and a circular economy researcher, puts that shifting to a circular economy is estimated to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions by up to 70%. Okay, I'm not going to get to such specific numbers in the slides here, but I hope by the end you can see how that at least would be possible in the ways that we're conceptualizing it here in KDE. It's not just me here on stage or KDE Eco that's recognizing autonomy and transparency is important for sustainable software. The Blue Angel, which is the official environmental label of the German government, also recognizes that autonomy and transparency are crucial to sustainable software design. And they have released eco certification criteria in 2020. In fact, in 2019, the last in-person CCC, Dr. Eva Kern and Marina Kern presented the Blue Angel criteria. You can take a look at that video online. They recognize that we need to have these qualities in order to reduce the energy consumption, environmental harm driven by software. So let's get to what is the problem. I'm going to talk about it here in two ways. I'm going to talk about it in terms of the energy and resource consumption driven by software, in particular in terms of CO2 emissions, as well as the environmental harm of e-waste. Let's do a little bit of history here. If you're interested in the history of climate science, I know that the researcher who presented yesterday, Maria Elena Forlat, is going to be doing a bit of history on climate science in the Science Slam tonight at 7 o'clock. So the issue of CO2 is not new. We've known this for over 150 years. The first researcher to recognize how CO2 will warm the planet was a woman, Eunice Newton Foote. It was actually presented by a man originally, later published under her name. She did several experiments looking at the effects of the sun on various gases. And what she found is that the highest effect of the sun's rays were in CO2. The receiver containing CO2 became itself much heated, and on being removed from the sun, it was many times as long in cooling. Okay, this is the first known climate science researcher. Fast forward about 60 years. This is an article from a magazine called Popular Mechanics in 1912. In which they comment that adding CO2 tends to make the air a more effective blanket for the Earth and to raise its temperature. This effect may be considerable in a few centuries. Okay, this is already, you know, this is more than 100 years ago. We've known about this problem for a long time. Let's look at now. Okay, this is a toot from a climate science researcher from the University of Reading, Ed Hawkins. You probably can't see all of the details of the graphs here. Just generally, they're all going up with the exception of one. The one that's not going up is the ice caps. All the others are CO2 emissions, global warming, etc. And Ed Hawkins comments that changes are emerging across the climate system. Everywhere we look, the climate is changing rapidly. These changes are not natural. They're primarily caused by the burning of fossil fuels. This is another project, an outreach campaign from Ed Hawkins called Show Your Stripes, in which you can make nice visualizations of the disturbing trend of global warming. This is the top graph here is for Hamburg, and the bottom one is for the global climate change. The baseline measurement is over three decades from 1970 to 2000. And then looking at the, in comparison to that baseline, the temperature going back to when Eunice Newton Foote made her first observations about the effect of CO2. Okay, and you can see that it's rapidly shifting towards a warming climate. I just saw an article 2 days ago in the New York Times that commented the warmest year on record was this year. And it's the warmest year since we've been taking records of the climate, of the temperature, in 174 years, I believe is the exact number. And according to our models, perhaps the warmest year in 125,000 years. Okay, we are in a climate crisis right now. What does this have to do with software? I haven't gotten there yet. Okay, this is a big picture overview of the greenhouse gas emissions of the ICT sector as a whole. This includes production, distribution, usage, includes training AI models, blockchain technology, et cetera. And this is a summary estimate from the Association of Computing Machinery. It's the oldest association of its type. This is from 2022. The summary is that right now the ICT sector is contributing between 1.8 and 3.9% of global greenhouse gas emissions, which is about on a par with the aviation industry, which is estimated to contribute 2.5%. And estimates going forward are that in the worst case, by 2050, if nothing has changed, we will be at 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions contributed by the ICT sector. Okay. Now, these estimates of projections vary widely based on various assumptions. If you're interested in some of that research, there's a link in the slide here to a meta-analysis of this type of projections of greenhouse gas emissions from ICT sector. Thank you. And the report comments that computing can help mitigate climate change, but must first cease contributing to it. So let's look at how software contributes to the greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm going to start with production. This is talking about hardware in particular, but you'll see at the end how this relates directly to software. There's a disproportionate impact of production. Okay. This is from the life cycle carbon assessment of Apple in 2017. It's Apple's own reports, looking at the iPhone 7 in terms of the proportional greenhouse gas contributions. And what they find is that production and transportation accounts for over 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions of an iPhone over its life cycle, which is assumed to be 4 years. Usage is only 18%. Right, and production not only has a disproportionate impact on greenhouse gas emissions, it also comes at huge social costs. right, including human rights violations. This is a picture from an article about the Supply Chain Due Diligence Act, which just came into effect, which means companies are now responsible for their supply chains in the material that goes into their products. The materials used for smartphone batteries, electric vehicle batteries, et cetera, require cobalt. This is child labor at a cobalt mine in the Congo, right? So the production of these devices come at huge costs. Let's look at usage, right? This is inefficiencies in computing, right? It's the hardware that's pulling the energy, but it's the software that's determining that. This is an example. This came up yesterday in Anke Domscheit-Berg's talk. This is a study published by the German Environmental Agency comparing different software products doing the exact same thing. That's referred to as a standard usage scenario. And here we're looking at just the word processors. This is word processor one is identified as an open source word processor. Word processor two is identified as a proprietary software product. And you can see here that the word processor two is consuming four times the energy doing the exact same thing as word processor one. Now, for an individual user, this isn't that significant. I mean, these are small numbers, but you have to scale it up. Right, you have to think that every university, every government office, every home has a word processor in it. Right, we're talking about potentially billions of users. A very simple example of scaling up. This is from a presentation by Detlef Toms. This is an example where you increase a process by one CPU second, which is about the equivalent of 10 watt seconds energy. And you make an assumption that that's multiplied by 1.5 million users. That's a very small number of users. It's a very modest assumption here. And assume that that process, that increase in the CPU time, happens 20 times a day that you trigger that increase. And 230 working days a year, right? Just with this simple calculation, back of the envelope calculation, you arrive at 19 megawatt hours of energy that's consumed in a year. To put that in perspective, that's about the equivalent of taking a modern electric vehicle and driving from Paris to Shanghai six times back and forth. Okay, this is from one CPU second change. Okay, now let's get to the disposal. In 2015, Achim Steiner from the UN Environmental Program commented that we are experiencing a tsunami of e-waste rolling out over the world. In 2016, the world generated 45 million tons of e-waste. That would be about the equivalent of material for 4,500 Eiffel Towers. To put that into perspective, if you were to stack those Eiffel Towers on top of each other, that would be 17 times higher than Mount Everest. This is in 2016. Less than 20% of e-waste actually gets recycled. Much of it stays in drawers or in closets, and a lot of it ends up in landfills. In landfills, although e-waste only makes up about 2% of the total waste, it contributes 70% of the toxic waste. 2019, the World Economic Forum declared e-waste as the fastest growing waste stream in the world. In 2022, we produced 60 million tons, so a 30% increase, and it's only increasing. There's also a lot of environmental harm done to people and animals and plants in e-waste disposal centers. This is a picture from Ghana, where there's a major e-waste end-of-life treatment center. This is a picture of burning of insulated cables. It's one of the hardest things to recycle. At the best case scenario, this end-of-life treatment is contributing toxic waste into air, land, and sea, and therefore land animals, sea animals, plants. Worst case, people scavenge these for precious metals, exposing them to toxic waste like mercury and lead. Okay. Software. Software design plays a critical role, right? Bloatware or feature creep, you might end up getting a message like, this device doesn't meet minimum system requirements, right? Programmers are programming their software to work on more and more powerful hardware and abandoning the older hardware early, right? You can do that. You can be inefficient when you have a lot at your disposal. abandonware or planned obsolescence. This device is no longer supported. I don't remember the exact numbers now, but in 2025, Windows 10 support is supposed to stop. Many of those devices cannot be updated to Windows 11. There are millions of laptops and desktop PCs that are now going to be e-waste because of this. Right? The result of this is that you have unnecessarily high energy consumption in use. Functioning devices are discarded as e-waste and end up in end-of-life treatment centers or worse, landfills. And new devices are produced and shipped unnecessarily. And this is due to software. There was a great example of this in yesterday evening's talk, which was just such an excellent talk about trains, right? Software design is often done in the vendor's interest, not in the user's, right? And this is such an egregious example of that in designing trains to malfunction if they're not being used the way the vendor wanted, right? This is waste. Right, we're creating extra waste. And when we do that, when these devices become obsolete because of software, right, we start the linear process over. And we replace that hardware by then producing, distributing new devices, using them, et cetera, and disposing them. Okay, so how does free and open source software fit into this? So I'm gonna talk today about how autonomy and transparency interrupt the linear model, in particular at the disposal stage, and enable a circular one. I'm going to talk about it in three different ways. Lean software, that is eliminating unnecessary processes for efficient hardware use. Vendor independence, for hardware use to the end of the hardware lifecycle, not the software lifecycle. And software recycling, that is integrating new code with existing code for new hardware support. So let's start with lean software. This is the reduced part of the 3R. So longer use of hardware. You can achieve that by doing the same task but having fewer hardware demands. Let's go back to that German Environmental Agency report, comparing those two word processors. Now we can look at that same, those are the same energy consumption measurements, but now over time. So on the x-axis you have the time, and the y-axis the power draw. And this is the top graph here, the green line is the open source software, and the bottom one is the proprietary software. They're not identified in the report. You can probably guess which software products they are. I've just reduced, so I've modified the image to just focus on, so opening the document is the first thing, and then the various tasks that are done in both software products at the same time, editing the text, changing the fonts, making the fonts larger, smaller, all the usual things you would do with a word processor. But I actually want to focus on that blue line that goes towards the right side of the plot. This is the point when the document is saved, and then the software goes idle, or it's supposed to go idle. You can see here there's a little small spike right after that bump that's, you know, writing to disk, doing the necessary processing. For the open source software product, it actually does go idle. You can see it falls into a baseline energy consumption. The proprietary software product continues doing things. Now, it doesn't say what it's doing in the report. It might be some really clever people can figure this out. It maybe do some network analysis, perhaps it's telemetry. It's maybe not in the benefit of the user. It might not have anything to do with the actual functionality of a word processor. We don't know. And this is one of the real powers of autonomy and transparency, is you can see what it's doing, and if you don't like it, you can change it. And by changing it, by removing those unnecessary processes, let's go back to that same scaling example. But this time, let's reduce the energy consumption. Just by reducing it by one CPU second, you reduce the energy consumption by about 10 watt seconds. And you can do the same back of the envelope calculations, and you end up at the same number, 19 megawatt hours of savings. This is for perhaps things that users don't want, right? Now, I've been giving a talk similar to this in various forms over the past 2 years, and if I can convince 500 developers, that's a very modest number, there's something like 10,000 plus people here, 500 developers to make just 10 of those kinds of changes, multiply it out by 19 megawatt hours, and we're talking about 95,000 megawatt hour savings. That's about the equivalent of the annual energy consumption of 30,000 two-person households. Okay, this quickly gets into small city level energy consumption. for very modest changes. And I'm going to come back to this idea of individual changes, collective savings, individual actions, collective actions towards the end. So what are we doing at KDE Eco? So this is some of the early work done measuring software. This is for Ocular. This is done in collaboration with the Umweltkampus Birkenfeld. They measured Ocular to see how much energy it was consuming, and this is the result. This is doing typical tasks that you would do with a document reader, like a PDF reader, opening the document, scrolling through the pages, highlighting some text, annotating it, and you can then see and correlate that with energy consumption. So the first step is measuring, right? We need the data. Now, up until recently, this, at least for us, was only accessible from an in-person lab, and we set up a lab about a year and a half ago, a little less than that. You can see that on the right side of the plot here. In KDAB Berlin, KDAB has been very generous, giving us a space in their offices to set up an actual physical lab. We have a system under test dedicated for measuring software, a power meter, an external power meter connected to it to record the energy draw. And then we have a data aggregator and evaluator, a Raspberry Pi, which is then triggering all the actions. Now, up until this summer, you had to actually go to the lab to use it. That's quite difficult, especially for an international community like KDE, to actually go to Berlin and do this work. So we have a great project this summer from Karanjot Singh under the tutelage of Volker Krauser, who's here among some others, to integrate this into the GitLab CI pipeline. So now when a developer makes changes and wants to see how the energy consumption changes, from the development of that software, they can prepare a standard usage scenario script, upload it into GitLab, and then trigger the measurement process. That then goes into the lab in KDAB Berlin, automates the entire process, gives you a report back, a summary report, which can be used either for data-driven decision-making about software development or for eco certification, which is then left as an artifact for the developer. So this has now all been automated. It's still a work in progress. If you're interested in this, we want this to be something that's available for all free software developers, not just KDE. If you're interested in it, please get in touch. We need people to test it. We need people to improve it. So we would love to have you join us. I'm going to skip this for the sake of time. I'm going to look at some other work that we're doing. So there's now, we're tagging bugs and merge requests with an efficiency tag so we can track the changes being done in terms of efficiency at KDE. This is not always just because of energy consumption measurements, but also just general bugs related to inefficiency, things like CPU spikes, freezing, hanging, et cetera. Since we started tagging this about, I think, a year ago, maybe a little bit more than that, this is from October, and I think we have about 350 efficiency MRs. It's probably more now. So we can now track the development that we're doing in KDE in terms of sustainability. Another aspect that I think a lot of free software users completely take for granted is that you can uninstall things. Right? This seems obvious if you are using Linux. It's not obvious to many other people. So uninstalling or selectively installing, only installing what you need and not more, not less, right, is going to make your system more lean, which means it's going to have, it's going to require less CPU when you start and shut down the computer. It's going to occupy less memory. When you do updates, you're going to be requiring less updates to be downloaded from the servers and then to be updated into your system. And the online, so interacting with the network is also consuming energy. And again, I think in the free software world, we take this for granted that you can use software offline and you can opt out of advertising. This is from a report for the EU about unwanted data use from EU smartphones. It's only related to smartphones, it's only related to EU. This is a nice plot showing the smartphones at the top there, and then connecting with a network, connecting with data centers, and the power that's needed to achieve all of that. They look at the ad and tracking services, how much energy would be saved if users could opt out of tracking that they don't want in the first place. And they estimate that to be about the equivalent of the annual energy consumption of, I think it was 350 to 950,000 EU citizens in 1 year. Okay, this is something that people don't want. That, just to put in perspective, is about the largest number, 950,000, is about the size of a city like Lisbon or Turin. So being able to opt out of that, being able to run offline, means that you're removing all of that extra energy consumption that you maybe don't want in the first place. All of this is making your software run leaner. All of it's making it more efficient. In KDE Eco, we are now working on documenting this and putting it into our about dialogue and KDE software, how the various aspects like uninstalling software, how to uninstall software, energy consumption reports, if there's eco-certified software. All of that is going into an eco tab. We're almost ready to do this. We have one obstacle right now, which is the web design. If anyone is a web designer here wants to help out, we'd love to have your help. And so that we can start to give this information to users so that they are aware of the ways that they can make their software run more efficiently. Okay, the second point, vendor independence and hardware use. So software freedom gives hardware value over its entire life cycle, right? That's the, going back to my mom giving me that laptop, that's exactly what was happening, right? The hardware still had value, but the software was making it not, giving at least the impression that it no longer had value. And this is a very similar example of this. Autonomy and transparency means that you can continue using hardware that the vendors didn't intend to be continued to use. This is a MacBook Pro from 2009. The end of software life was in 2019. It's still, this is a real example, it's still in use. There was a KDE contributor when I was asking around of examples of this, that they are still using this hardware with up-to-date software today. Okay, I'm going to skip over for the sake of time and go to the last point and then wrap up. Software recycling. There's a really cool project I saw a talk about at Ubuntu Summit, Asahi Linux project. You may know about it. They are porting Linux to the new Apple Silicon, and they're doing some really amazing work. They're able to provide a fully functional system because they can take the work that they're doing, which is incredible, and integrate it with existing code. In this case, Plasma, very proud to say, KDE Plasma, with the next release of Fedora Linux 40, KDE Plasma 6, which will be a major release in February. They can integrate that with existing code and provide a fully functional system for users. And that, of course, then, when you go down the line of that linear model, means that later on, or right now, we can start to make it more run more efficiently. And when Apple no longer supports that hardware, you can continue to use it in other ways because now we have a fully functioning software system for it. And again, using the terminology of the theme of the CCC this year, vendor dependency means your hardware is locked because of the software, and it's unlocked because of free software. So I'll stop here so we have some time for questions. And thank you very much.
So we have a couple of minutes. For questions. What's going on there? We have four microphones in the room, and we have a signal angel online. And I see a question from microphone number one.
Yes, hi. Thanks for the great talk. A lot of insights, and I like the labeling in the merge request area for efficiency, and thought about manually or even automatically assigning the labels due to the output of unit tests or something. But this would mean you have a laboratory-like environment, run all the unit tests, and know the performance per executed test unit, and assign this then and see if energy is increased or not. Have you thought about implementing such a process to fully automate the assignment of labels?
Fully automation of the labels, no, we haven't thought about. So that's something we can think about. It makes a lot of sense. So thank you for the comment. Yeah. thank you.
So we have many questions I can see in very little time. Keep your question brief and to the point. Microphone three.
Yes, my question is, the picture you show up with the iPhone 7 about, 80% during the production and 20 in the usage, for which duration? What is this picture?
So the assumption in their report is a lifespan of 4 years. So that's Apple's assumption. That's for their iPhones. For their laptops and desktops, it's 5 years.
So question from microphone two.
Yes, I was wondering, as a long-term KDE user, I noticed that the KDE Plasma desktop has become much more efficient over recent years, and I always attributed this to Plasma Mobile, the MAP Plasma Mobile project. How much of that did, these better optimizations for Plasma Mobile, how much did that play a role in this development? Thank you.
So I can't speak specifically to that because I'm not developing Plasma Mobile. I don't know if I can speak generally to that, but I don't know if anyone from KDE who's working on Plasma Mobile would like to. Yes, yes. The answer is yes. and that would be I would suspect that would be the case because the flip side of energy efficiency, of course, is also optimization. They're not the same, but they're going to be related to each other. And that's already something developers are doing right now. So
microphone four.
Yeah, thank you. You forgot the 99% of all devices in embedded systems. And now my question, we are planning at the IT faculty of the University in Heilbronn to make a new bachelor track for efficient programming and efficient embedded systems. And now my question, do you think it's attractive for young people for this track because we are new in this field and we have no idea, is it really attractive to get a programmer who is able for efficiency programming and algorithm?
I think yes, and if it's not, I hope the work I'm doing is making it attractive. And that's what I'm trying to, when I get up here and talk about the work that other people are really doing, is to try to make this a topic that is something people want to care about. But yes, I think already it is.
So very briefly, microphone one.
Yes, thank you for your great talk. You had this nice graph about the life cycle of the iPhones, and I would be interested if you have something similar for laptops. Especially if you use older laptops. I have some old ones which have a very high energy consumption compared to newer ones, and where this levels out, if it's okay to use an old one or better to use a newer one. Thank you.
Yeah, so there is a sweet spot where retiring old hardware because of its inefficiency actually outweighs the negative impacts of the production and distribution. Where that sweet spot is, I don't know if anyone has actually come up with a number. And if you are a researcher in this area and you know of a number, let me know or do the research. I don't know the numbers offhand, but that report from Apple does have also numbers for the laptop and desktop domain. And that's great that they're publishing that. So you can come up with a similar plot for their devices in their report.
So we're rapidly running out of time. Really quickly, three.
Thanks for your inspirational talk. Are you aware of any differences concerning the first part of your talk in hardware architectures and their energy consumptions, like be it GPU, CPU, or ARM architecture, Intel, whatever? Is there some work done on that too?
There is work done on that by researchers doing a lot more than I'm doing, and I can't really speak to it. But yes, there is work done on that. I've seen talks where they're looking at the energy consumption and distributing tasks through CPU and GPU and things like this. If you look online, I'm sure you'll find something. And if you want to talk later, I can try to give you some resources that might help you find those answers to those questions.
And thank you. And very, very last question, microphone number two.
So ultimately, free software users are a vast minority in computing. So this sort of feels like the debate between like vegetarians and vegans about who's most environmentally efficient when like people are eating 20 hamburgers a day. I'm wondering what you can think we can do to drive adoption among more less tech savvy users to try and gain some more of these benefits.
So I've been able to convince, for example, people in my family to start using Linux when their laptops couldn't be updated from Microsoft. And I said, why throw that away? I can install a easy to use Linux distribution, give it a try, and that convinced them. And I think we have a really big opportunity coming up in 2025 when the end of life for Windows 10 happens for many users. I mean, there are literally like hundreds of millions of devices that are gonna be e-waste at that point. I think we can do campaigns to start raising awareness about this issue and trying to target those users. Of course, it's a completely different, you know, we're a decentralized, self-organized, in many respects, community, and we don't have the kind of financial backing of a company like Microsoft or Apple. But I do think we have resources available to us. KDE has a project in mind that will be an outreach campaign related to this, which hopefully we will start in 2024 and go for a couple of years. So hopefully we can start to take advantage of the poor practices of other companies to raise awareness of how free software can actually keep those devices in use, which many people want.
Okay. Right? And with that, we're at the end of our talk. Thank you very much. Please help me by thanking Joseph on this amazing talk.